The Baseball Tonight podcast is presented by LinkedIn Jobs.
Way out of here. Oh, goodness.
This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is a Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, June 17th, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. And I think, Taylor, we learned last night, we're not allowed to have shiny things, i.e. the dominant Jacob deGrom.
Very sad stuff, man. After Tyler Glasnow. I mean, what is... This is ridiculous. What are we doing here? I'm distraught. I can tell
it's
you are
crazy. It just was heartbreaking. He was so good last night in the early innings. He's pumping the fastball at 101. He's throwing nasty sliders. After a couple of innings, you're wondering, you know, could he flirt with a strikeout record? Could he flirt with some kind of a no hitter? And he was doing damage at the plate.
Swinging a ground ball, base hit going into right field. Can you believe this? Jacob deGrom does it again. In the score is Pillar. DeGrom with a big turn at first goes back with his sixth run batted in of the year. He's 11 for 26 at the plate. The Mets have a 2-0 lead. And never mind the fact that this crowd is standing. Many of them are bowing to Jacob deGrom.
Jacob deGrom, six RBI this year, four earned runs allowed. He's been so good in so many respects. Now batting over 400. The crowd was really into it at Citi Field last night. They were chanting MVP. His teammates were going crazy. Here he was in the third inning.
His 1-2 pitch to Stock. That's in there. Strike three called. Fastball at the bottom of the zone on the inside corner. 100 miles an hour. And Jacob deGrom strikes out the side once again. That's seven in a row and eight in the game for deGrom against the first nine hitters he's faced.
But then, after the commercial break, this is what we learned.
Well, his results have been overwhelming, but clearly something was bothering Jacob deGrom in that last inning. And when it was over, he went directly down the tunnel. So we'll just have to keep our eye out.
And that was it. He faced nine hitters last night. He struck out eight of them, and then he had to leave the game. He talked about what happened with reporters after the game.
You know, felt good warming up, felt really good in the first and second inning, and then... there in the third, you know, my shoulder was sore. This is getting old, you know. I want to be out there competing and coming out of these games with these little, you know, hopefully this turns out to be nothing. Me, I expect to go out there and give us depth, and, you know, I haven't done that like I expect out of myself, you know, and the bullpen's done a great job of picking me up, but, you know, I can't keep doing that to those guys, you know, so I think that's going to be a decision based on, you know, what we see tomorrow, and that'll probably be a discussion to be had. But the competitor in me wants to be out there. But like I said, it's frustrating leaving games early.
So on May 4th, he was scratched from his start because of discomfort in his right side. May 9th, he was pulled after five innings because of discomfort in his right side. He went on the injured list. He missed two starts. June 11th, he was pulled after six innings because of discomfort in his right elbow. And then last night, the shoulder issue. Here was Luis Rojas, the Mets manager, after the game.
I mean, I got to keep it low, right? Because right now, I'm just getting what we got tonight, right? He told us what he was feeling. He's feeling some soreness in the in his shoulder. And then at the beginning, I am concerned, right? This thing's happening again, and now we want to find out what it is. But then during the game, I got a report that it was a we could call it an encouraging report from the initial test that they usually take as far as like trying to figure out the strength in his right shoulder compared to his left shoulder, and then, you know, both about the same. So talked to Jake after the game, and his level of concern is low as well. So we just let, you know, I think tomorrow should be a you know, big day as far as like getting some more results from the test, and then we'll see.
The Mets won this game, by the way, defeating the Cubs. They now lead the National League East by five games. They have a 7.5 game lead over the Atlanta Braves, who won this division for three straight years. DeGrom wasn't the only guy hurt in Major League Baseball yesterday. Houston Astros third baseman Alex Bregman left Wednesday's game with strained left quad. We'll get more information about that later today. The Philadelphia Phillies place Gene Segura on the injured list with a groin injury. He'll be out at least 3 weeks. Bryce Harper had a stiff lower back. He is day-to-day about when he's going to come back. Yesterday, Shohei Ohtani put on a variety show. In the second inning, he came to the plate.
Well, and that one.
He did it again. Got him!
That was his 19th homer. That, of course, the voice of Matt Viscursion calling that home run. In his next plate appearance, it was something very different from Ohtani.
Homers. I've never heard of a hitter tipping with his hands. He's going to hit a homer. He's going to bunt single here.
Oh, yeah.
What did you say about him before? He's not of this world.
He's a space alien. Yeah. I mean, this is an really. I mean, he hit a ball 450 feet earlier, and then he sucks in the third baseman and boom.
But in keeping with the Angels season, they lost to Oakland. Ohtani is scheduled to pitch today, so that'll be fun to watch. There were walk-offs all around the big leagues, like in the south side of Chicago.
1-0. A drive to right. Off the wall. White Sox win. Yasmani Grandal with a walk-off single. 8-7 the final as they mob him behind the mound. What a ball game.
Len Casper, ESPN 1000. There was a walk-off in St. Louis.
The pitch. A hot shot, fair. It goes down the left field line. Here comes Paul Goldschmidt for a Redbird winner. Yadier Molina drives in the winner in the bottom of the ninth. The Cardinals have swept the Marlins, winning 1-0 at Busch Stadium. And they mob Yadi.
And there was a walk-off in Colorado.
Nobody out. 7-7 game. The pitch. Charlie hits it into center field. It's a base hit. Trevor Story around third. He scores. Chuck Nasty completes the sweep.
That sound from 850 KOA. Now, the Red Sox and Braves had a big battle. Garrett Richards struggled. He didn't throw one curveball last night, and he was very direct about the situation with foreign substances.
I think tonight spoke for itself. I'm not going to get caught up in it all, but I'll definitely say it's starting to affect people, you know, people in their careers. So, we're going to follow the rules, but, this is the game you're going to get. So
in Buffalo, Garrett Cole pitched well against the Toronto Blue Jays, but with a different style, a lot more changeups. The Yankees trailed by a run and Gary Sanchez came to the plate.
That one's hit deep to left field. There it goes. See ya. A pinch hit. Two-run home run for Gary Sanchez.
Yeah, that was, of course, the unmistakable call of Michael Kay. He'll be joining us later in the podcast to talk about his new book and to talk about what's going on with the Yankees. By the way, in the middle of that game, Joe Panik made an error. And Ross Stripling, the Blue Jays pitcher, screamed angrily at him. After the game, Ross Stripling was very apologetic, said that his response to Panik was, quote unquote, the most disrespectful thing I've ever done, maybe ever. I'm completely embarrassed about it. And after the game, Garrett Cole became the latest pitcher to call out MLB. We'll hear from him in a moment. Now, before we get to Sarah Langs and Michael Kay, The Ultimate Fighter is back. Stream new episodes every Tuesday, only on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com/UFC. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL.
Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
0096. This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter and a producer for MLB.com and also a Mets fan. And Sarah, last night, it was just heartbreaking the way that it played out with DeGrom. The crowd was into it. Everyone was excited. They're chanting MVP at Citi Field. He gets a base hit, six RBI and four runs allowed. And then the air goes out of the building when he has to leave after three innings.
Yeah, you know, it was really concerning to see. I think SNY at one point after he came out showed this fan who looked like he was maybe like 9 years old, just looking so upset and concerned. Probably when Sean Reed Foley walked in, no disrespect to Sean Reed Foley. And I think that was pretty much every baseball fan last night seeing that happen. I mean, you know, we knew that there were questions whether he would make this start given what had happened in his previous start when he threw only 80 pitches and had the tendonitis. So certainly not what you want to see. And you hope that he'll be okay because we are watching history, but it is very stressful now. Most of these days just with, you know, he's dealt with a handful of injuries or bits and pieces of injuries so far this year.
A 0.54 ERA. He struck out 111 of the 232 batters he's faced, 48%. That's crazy good. And yet, you know, after a start in which he strikes out eight of the nine batters he's faced, it's a conversation about level of concern. And I'm not asking you this as a Mets fan, but just as someone who's observed baseball and watched pitchers and seen how injuries played out. Scale of 1 to 10, what's your level of concern about DeGrom?
I think it has to be relatively high. I mean, I'm very bad at these scales. Sometimes people are like, really that low, that high, when it's probably not what I meant. But I guess I would say around a 6.5 or a 7, if not a little bit higher. I'm just concerned because he's dealt with, I think there's about 4 or 5 different injuries this year when you think of the side and the elbow and the back and now the shoulder. And you know, I think that there's an argument to be made that, okay, at least it's not the same injury cropping up every time, because that probably indicates something that we tend to associate with, okay, then someone needs surgery. But on the other hand, you just wonder, I mean, we talk about his effortless 100 mile an hour pitches and everything else, but you really wonder about all of that and about the toll of the game when he's had these different sorenesses and injuries in a couple different places now this season.
Yeah, I got to believe that there are potentially two conversations happening in the Mets organization today. One, are all of these injuries related somehow? DeGrom, in what he said after the game last night, seemed to feel like that they were isolated, like that the elbow thing wasn't that big of a deal, that the, you know, the core issue that he dealt with was more on a swing, and that the shoulder issue last night wasn't, you know, was something that wasn't that big of a deal either. But the Mets and the Mets medical staff have to be answering the question, are these somehow related? And the other one, Sarah, I was thinking about last night was about his velocity increase, which we've talked about and lauded. You know, it's unprecedented, adding 4 or 5 miles per hour on his fastball in recent years. And I actually was thinking last night about, you know, the fact that you're a runner. I ran in high school. And there was an all-time great runner named Steve Prefontaine. And he philosophically hated the idea of runners using other runners during the course of a race, drafting behind each other, sort of pulling back on their effort in certain times in the race, and then ramping it up at other times. He really believed in the idea of, you know what, from the beginning of the race to the end of the race, the purest way to do this is run as hard as you can. You know, think about someone running a race that way. Well, that's kind of what DeGrom's been doing with his velocity. Like from the first pitch all the way to his last pitch, he's throwing 100 miles per hour, which we've never seen a starting pitcher do. We've only seen that with relievers in these short bursts. And he's doing it for 5, 6, 7 innings. And I do wonder if they have to have a conversation about, you know, Jacob, this is not sustainable. You know, we have not seen any starting pitcher who can maintain velocity like now, launch their bodies the way that you are. You know, I know they've had conversations with him in the organization about the risk reward of throwing this hard. You wonder if the risks now are beginning to build up.
It's interesting because I think as we've seen this velocity increase happen, and we've seen it happen in real time, really starting with that 2019 season, the, you know, second clause of every sentence was, well, but it's okay because he hasn't gotten hurt because of it. And we're so conditioned to believe that when guys throw 100, they're bound to get hurt. And it does seem now that, you know, he's throwing harder than ever. He's throwing harder than any starter ever, as you said. And there have been injuries, so it's hard to know the exact correlation, causation, all of that. But it does seem that perhaps leveling, you know, pulling that back a little bit could be of use. I mean, there's this note I feel like I update every time he pitches. He's thrown like 5,500 mile an hour pitches in the first inning in the last 2 years, and nobody else has thrown more than 800 mile an hour pitches in the first inning. And it was Sixto Sanchez, and they were all last year. He hasn't even pitched yet this year. So other starters who do have some modicum of velocity like this, even if it isn't quite as fast as DeGrom's, are not necessarily coming out, you know, blazing with that in the first inning. So that's sort of what crystallizes to me, is maybe to dial it back there. And I also think about, I mean, it's an entirely different pitcher, but do you remember that Shohei Ohtani start like 2 or 3 weeks ago where he had no velocity whatsoever? And we were very concerned that he was injured. He ended up being okay. He hasn't missed a start since then. But since then, he hasn't been throwing quite as hard. He's thrown a handful of 100 mile an hour pitches this year, but they were all before that start. And if you look at his arsenal and his velocity since then, it's not an injured type of, you know, diagnosis or types of velocities, but it does seem that he is purposefully perhaps not throwing as hard and trying to stay in the game longer. Again, a very different pitcher, but the one that comes to mind for me who has in the midst of the season made an adjustment there, and it does seem to be helping him stay healthy and stay on the mound.
Which for, you know, decades was standard operating procedure for starting pitchers. You know, you and I would watch, a Roger Clemens, a Pedro Martinez, a Clayton Kershaw, where they might be throwing, you know, in Pedro's case, he might be throwing 92 to 93. And all of a sudden in a big spot, he'd throw 96. You know, I'd see Roger do that in the years that I covered him. Kershaw, you know, in a big spot, like in his last inning, last hitter, he'll ramp up his velocity as opposed to being maximum velocity. And again, to draw another analogy, imagine if you're driving a sports car and you put it in red right at the outset and try to maintain that all the way through. You're probably, in some cases, you're going to blow out the engine. And I do wonder about that in terms of how DeGrom is pitching this season. Man, I hope he's okay. I know you do too, because he's so much fun to watch. He's such a great competitor. And if, in fact, you know, this is about him going max effort from first pitch to, you know, last pitch, there's something really to laud in that. And you just hope it works out and that he's going to be okay. All right. I'm curious across the board, what you saw in pitchers last night. We're going to get to what Gerrit Cole said in a minute, but for example, in his start, you know, the Gerrit Cole that we've seen in the past was not the Gerrit Cole we saw last night, where he was throwing a ton of changeups. Garrett Richards of the Red Sox came into his start last night having thrown about 16% curveballs. Last night, he didn't throw a single curveball. I think clearly what's happening all around the sport is pitchers are learning to adjust without foreign substances, and the pitch selections are very different.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I think that all of this, you know, I'm a daughter of a scientist. I work in numbers, so I'm always very hesitant to initially jump to conclusions. But I do think that we're seeing certain pitchers anecdotally, like the two that you mentioned, maybe make certain adjustments. I do want to say that with Cole, with the changeup, I mean, that's been an added pitch for him this year. His second highest changeup rate in any game of his career was actually on April 30th, before we heard any of these conversations. So that's a new pitch that he's added that's been really, really good for him. His top three usages on it have been this season, and the highest was last night, but the other two were in April and May. So it's not, I mean, I am sure that it is perhaps related to wanting to throw fewer breaking balls. As you're saying, I would certainly believe that, but I will say with that, that's been an added pitch for him that's just made him even better in certain ways this year. But I do think Garrett Richards was interesting. So as you mentioned, he threw all four seamers and sliders last night, and he was averaging 16% curveballs. He hadn't had a start where he didn't throw a curveball since 2015. You know, some relief appearances in there, whatever else, but those are fewer pitches thrown. And I do think that it's possible that we might see other pitchers adjusting like this, but I think that if that's what's going to help them, you know, under these new rules and protocols, maybe that's what's best to see. I mean, I don't think that Garrett Richards not throwing a curveball is, you know, in the realm of the stuff that Tyler Glasnow was saying, for instance. I mean, that's just choosing to throw different pitch types. He threw his four-seamer and his slider, which he's used to throwing. So I do think there's a difference there.
Gerrit Cole, after his start last night, was, you could see in his face, he was trying to keep under control, but talk about something that was really bothering him. Give a listen.
I just can't. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to, it's so hard to grip the ball. I just, you know, I mean, for Pete's sake, it's part of the reason why almost every player on the field has something, regardless if they're a pitcher or not, to help them control the ball. I think that I don't have a solution, but again, we are aligned in a lot of areas with the commissioner's office on this. And please just talk to us. Please just work with us. I know you have the hammer here, but you know, we've been living in a gray area for so long. I would just hate to see players get hurt. I would hate to see balls start flying at people's heads. I had a really tough time gripping the baseball tonight, especially early when it was windy. So I don't really care to be inflammatory here, Joel. I'm just going to leave it at that.
So it was very interesting to listen to this last night. He's 100% right, Sarah, that, you know, Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred had basically pushed this new initiative in an unusual manner upon the players in midseason. And they've done it essentially unilaterally, telling the umpires to enforce a rule that hasn't really been enforced for decades. But it also kind of makes me crazy to hear him say this, because my feeling is, to some degree, please talk. Like, to me, this whole situation has illuminated the fact that there's just not a productive, collaborative relationship between the Players Association and Major League Baseball. In the last 48 hours, I think it's based on what we've heard from everyone, from Tyler Glasnow to Gerrit Cole to, you know, Pete Alonso the other day, there could potentially be middle ground to be found to give pitchers, you know, perhaps use of sunscreen. Maybe you have the umpires check and make sure there's not too much volume, but some kind of a tacky grip. The problem is that the two sides aren't really even talking. You know, during this foreign substance conversation, a lot of the back and forth between Major League Baseball and the Player Association went through the umpires. It wasn't directly. And so when I hear Gerrit say that, I'm like, Gerrit, if you got together with Clayton Kershaw and Josh Donaldson and Giancarlo Stanton and you wanted to have a Zoom call with the commissioner and try to find some middle ground, I think, you know, that conversation could happen, but it hasn't been happening, and it drives you crazy. Rich Hill, who's the oldest pitcher in baseball, came out yesterday and said, in his opinion, the union dropped the ball because, you know, in his words, I think this is where something should have been done. The Player Association had the opportunity to work with MLB, and MLB used a strong hand to put it on the players, and that's unfortunate that this is what happened. That's exactly how I feel. Like, go and have the conversation, Sarah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I was not aware of exactly, you know, what all went into how they arrived at this point and how, you know, this memo got sent and all of that. But it does seem that, you know, collaboration is always the best answer to anything, right? And, you know, maybe there'll be some evolution here. I mean, certainly we've seen just in the couple of weeks that this has been a conversation, it feels like things have evolved pretty quickly. So perhaps there could be, you know, a change down the road. I honestly have no idea. But, you know, I think that it's interesting. I mean, we'll see what all continues to play out. But I just hope that, you know, these pitchers continue to adapt, as we were talking about, you know, as some did last night, you know, a couple of guys that we were mentioning, and that continues to happen.
Rich Hill, to continue his comments, he said, I feel like they should have come together and settled this and handled it like professionals. I feel like a rule change in the middle of the season is very difficult for everybody across the league. And sorry, Sarah, for my rant, but it drives me crazy that that there can't be a conversation. It does feel like in the NBA, when Adam Silver, LeBron James, there's some issue that everyone – you know, wants to find a good solution, that conversation could be had directly. Okay, what works for you? What works for us? How can we get there? This is the path we're going to take. And it just doesn't seem to happen in baseball. And it kind of drives me crazy. I apologize.
Nothing to apologize for. I love the emotion. I don't know. I do think that based on those comments, it seems like, you know, there could be a further down the line. This obviously is not the last we've heard of this, right? I mean, we're going to be continuing to be looking at what pitchers are doing on a night to night basis and really assessing that. And obviously when this does go into effect, there will be even more of a microscope or magnifying glass to take your pick on all of this. But I do think that maybe, like, my optimistic view would be that maybe those comments do lead to, you know, some galvanization and some conversations, if that's what would be best for everybody.
Yes. At the very least, folks on both sides can ask the question, why are we not talking? All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, a Foxaloner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provides one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Michael Kay is the television voice for the Yankees on the YES Network. He's also the host of the Michael Kay Show on 98.7 FM on ESPN Radio and the host of Center Stage, in which he interviews a range of guests from athletes to actors. And his new book is out this week, Center Stage, My Most Fascinating Interviews from A-Rod to Jay-Z, with backstories and the best parts of a lot of those interviews. Congrats on the book, Michael.
Thank you, Buster. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Now, I'm going to ask you about the Yankees, maybe get a little foreign substance talk after Gerrit Cole's comments last night. But first, I want to talk to you about your book. I've read it. I've really enjoyed it. And what was cool was before each presentation of the interviews that you did in the book, you gave some perspective and some behind-the-scenes gives and take, which those were fun. Like, when I talk to my friends about my job, those are the stories they want to hear. So I was glad to hear those. So I'm going to go do a little rapid fire for you on some of your interviews. What was the favorite interview you've done for Center Stage, and why did you like that interview so much?
We've done 240 interviews, and my favorite one would be Larry David. I was really excited when we booked him. Big fan of Seinfeld, big fan of Curb. And I was also a little bit nervous because, you know, he's so smart and the things he's done, you know, he's kind of brilliant in his area of expertise. And I just didn't know how he would be on the stage, if he was going to be like Larry David from Curb. And he was, except he wasn't as mean. And he said that he thinks like that. But if he says the things that he said on Curb in real life, he'd probably get beaten up. So we actually became friends from that, Buster, where, like, he's a huge Yankee fan, and not just like, you know, sometimes you get celebrity fans and it's kind of surface. He really knows the Yankees and he knows the Jets. And, you know, during Yankee games, I'll see a text come up on my phone. Why did they do that? I don't understand how they did that. So just to become like quasi friends with Larry David from that interview, that made the interview worthwhile.
Man. To have him on your phone, that's pretty cool. The worst interview subject and why?
That would be Dennis Quaid. he was doing the movie The Rookie. Remember that the Jim Morris story? About the teacher who ended up making it to the big leagues in his late 30s. So he played Jim Morris, and he got to the studio, and he thought it was like a Kelly Ripa. Ryan Seacrest sort of thing, 8 minutes and you're out. I don't know why his publicist wouldn't tell him it's an hour commitment. He was in a bad mood. He had just broken up with Meg Ryan like the week before, and he sat down and he just wasn't ready to play. So for the first two segments, Buster, he's going yes and no to all the answers. No expansive answers, nothing like that. So it's an 8-segment show, and I leaned over after the second segment was over during the commercial spot. And I said, the show's an hour. Whether you go yes or no, it's still an hour. I got thousands of questions. I'm not going to look bad. You're going to look really bad. So you could decide how this is going to go moving forward. And I think he was startled because a lot of people don't talk to Hollywood celebrities like that. And he got a little bit better, but it was still the worst interview we've done.
Yeah, I read that and I just laughed out loud with your description. And I'm curious, since the book has come out, have you heard from anybody in his camp?
No, no one. And you know what's really disappointing, Buster, is I've seen him on late night shows like Kimmel and Fallon and Colbert, and he's great. Like, he's funny. He knows how to tell a story, but maybe he just didn't like my face. I don't know.
In the interviews you do, there's always going to be the uncomfortable topic, something that, as you're getting ready for it, you're wondering how the person's going to react. What is the toughest subject that you've had to talk about with someone? What do you remember about the reaction?
Well, I remember the one time I thought I was going to get hit was Mike Tyson. And that interview has a lot of layers and a lot of backstories to it. But like, I asked Mike Tyson, what's the deal with the tattoo on your face? And he goes, what? I said, you have a tattoo on your face. And I thought, he leaned forward. I thought he was going to belt me. And he ended up just answering the question. It was, that's where I decided to put it, something like that. But that interview, Buster, was so raw. Like, alternate times on the stage, he's weeping uncontrollably. Then he goes into laughing uncontrollably. And then, like, he's angry and sad. And all of the people that were in the audience that day were riveted. And I found this out after I wrote the book. In fact, I found it out a week and a half ago. That after that interview airs on Yes, and Spike Lee was watching the interview. And the interview finishes, and he picks up the phone, and he calls up Mike Tyson and said, that's a one-man Broadway show. We're bringing that to Broadway. What you just did on center stage, that's the show. And they ended up having a hit Broadway show from that, and he was great. I just wonder how I got lost in the shuffle. I would have liked some Broadway time.
Exactly. Who was much different than what you expected among the people you've interviewed?
When I interviewed A-Rod, it was 2003. And how A-Rod's really polished now? I mean, you work with him on Sunday nights and, always dressed to the nines. I don't think he got what the show was. He was at Texas then. And he came into the studio and he had on jeans and a t-shirt. And to this day, he jokes with me, I wish I knew exactly what... because he's, Derek Jeter's been on and he had like a $5,000 suit on. And I think that is the reason we put that interview in the book is that, young A-Rod, before all of the trouble started, you just kind of read between the lines of what he said and you kind of try to foreshadow. Was there any foreshadowing there? And there's a little bit, but I just thought he'd be more buttoned up. And I think that if that interview was done today, he'd be completely different and he'd look completely different. But I think it embarrasses him when he sees tapes of that he had on a white t-shirt and jeans, and that's just not Alex.
Who's your great white whale? The interview that you really, really, really would love to do, but you haven't been able to get that person yet.
I've got a couple of Moby Dicks. One's Bruce Springsteen. The other one's Billy Joel. And I'd like to get Michael Jordan. And I've always wanted to get as many ex-presidents as we could on the air. And we had an opportunity once, Buster. Bill Clinton had written a book about golf. And so his publicist and the booker for our show agreed that he'd come on the show. And then my producer told me that he will only answer questions about golf, nothing about the presidency. And I actually turned him down. I said, I don't want to, I look like an idiot just asking him about golf. So I feel like really powerful that I turned down the president. So I don't know if he'd be on the white whale list, but Springsteen, Billy Joel, and Michael Jordan would be the top three.
I'm a little surprised you haven't gotten Springsteen or Billy Joel based on, I mean, it seems like their relationship with baseball, like there seems to be some fandom there.
I've tried. I had Steve Van Zandt on. I know people who know Billy Joel, but, you know, as I mentioned, it's a long commitment and, you know, famous people don't have that much time. I'm surprised that we've gotten the A-list people that we've had, but yeah, Springsteen has eluded me. I think we've come closer to Billy Joel, but not close enough.
Well, maybe they're scared of you. Again, the name of the book is Center Stage, My Most Fascinating Interviews from A-Rod to Jay-Z. From 30,000 feet, what's wrong with the Yankees?
I think that the way the game has evolved has caught up with them. The game of baseball in 2021, this is not the team you would build for that. So when people want to blame Aaron Boone for what's going on, I can't sign off on that, Buster. I think this is a poorly constructed team that the only way they do win is if they hit home runs. And it's very difficult to hit home runs. Maybe things will change with the sticky stuff situation and pitchers maybe coming down to earth a little bit. Not quite sure. But they don't know how to create runs. They're terrible running the bases. They're not a good defensive team. They can't play any kind of small ball, which they wouldn't do anyway because that's not the way the team is built. And they're extraordinarily right-handed. And it has nothing to do with the short porch and right at Yankee Stadium, Buster. It has everything to do with what they would say would be lanes. You look at their lineup, and when they face a team like Tampa Bay that could bring a Fairbanks in from the bullpen and know that without any fear, there's going to be seven straight right-handed batters to face. If you look at the lefties on this team, 37-year-old Brett Gardner, Tyler Wade, who's really not an offensive force, and Rougned Odor, who failed so spectacularly in Texas that they're paying him big money for the next 2 years not to play. So their left-handed side is just non-existent, and that's why I think it's a poorly constructed team. And, you know, a long answer to your question, I just think they haven't hit enough home runs to win. And if they don't hit home runs, they won't win.
You know, as you were just talking, it really just jumped out of me like a light bulb went off over my head. You remember the quote from, and I'm paraphrasing more, Billy Bean in Moneyball saying, well, our stuff doesn't work in the postseason. You know what? In a weird sort of way, I feel like the Yankees have gotten to where Oakland was, you know, for years and years and years, where they were constructed team that would have success over 162 game regular season. But when you faced a better than average pitcher or better than average team in the postseason, maybe that stuff doesn't work quite so much. And it does make a difference that your lineup is very right-handed or you don't have a lot of diversity in your offense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I've had long arguments with Aaron Boone about it. And I said, you're not going to hit as many home runs in the playoffs. And then he brings out stats and says that teams score a higher percentage of runs in the playoffs on home runs rather than they do in the regular season. I said, but still, in big games, you're going to face the best pitchers, and great pitchers don't give up that many home runs unless they make mistakes, and great pitchers don't make as many mistakes. And the thing that Billy Bean said in Moneyball, and I've heard it with the Yankees too when we've had Brian Cashman on the radio show, it infuriates me when they say, you know, our stuff works, and then it's a crapshoot in the postseason. Well, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. Well, then construct a team where it's not a crapshoot in the postseason and also can be successful in a 162-game slate. I think that's laziness. I really do. And in a league where, you know, five teams are going to make the playoffs anyway, the Yankees with a $200 million payroll should make the playoffs. That should be a gimme no matter what system you have instituted. And the system that you have actually built a team on should actually succeed in October. Because George Steinbrück always said, unless we win a World Series, the season was a failure. Well, that means that every season since 2009 has been a failure. I think that's a really weak excuse that, you know, it's a crapshoot in the playoffs. Well, then that's not a good system that you've built.
All right, last one for you. I get asked this question all the time. Is Aaron Boone in trouble? And I always counter that. To me, that question's kind of off the mark. The more important question is, what's the level of confidence that Hal Steinbrenner has in general manager Brian Cashman? Because if Brian continues, I think Aaron Boone will continue. What do you think?
I think you're right. I really believe that Brian is kind of a de facto member of the Steinbrenner family. He's been around for 35 years. They trust him. He does the right thing by the Yankees. And I always say this about a manager in trouble. And I don't know if you agree with me, but if you've got a system where the manager is in lockstep with the front office, where he's executing their game plan, making their numbers play on the field, resting the players that they want them to rest, if any manager got fired, it would be the height of hypocrisy by the front office, and it would just be giving the front office a little bit of a pass. Aaron Boone and Brian Cashman and his staff are one. Aaron Boone is the guy who executes what the front office wants. And I'm not saying Aaron Boone's a puppet. You know him. He's a guy who really believes in this stuff. So if you take a guy who really believes in this stuff, is a good man, never embarrasses the organization, and has been given a very flawed roster, how is it his fault? Now, talk radio, everybody wants his scalp. It's him. It's his fault. But I agree with you. As long as Brian Cashman's there, and Brian Cashman's a good man, how could Brian Cashman in good conscience say Aaron Boone's the problem? Aaron Boone's not the problem. He's doing and carrying out what you guys want him to. So I don't think Aaron Boone's in trouble. Now, if the Yankees don't make the playoffs this year, it's going to be very interesting to see what the Steinbrenner family does concerning Brian Cashman, because then the whole thing could be flipped over.
Yep. And Brian has never fired a coach, let alone a manager, as you know, in season. And it'd be interesting because you and I both know, you know, if they don't make the playoffs, the legitimate questions to be asked by Hal Steinbrenner about what baseball ops has been doing. But if they fire Brian Cashman and move on, he'll take him 0.2 seconds to get a job someplace else because of the respect he has around baseball.
That's what I tell the people that call into the show that want him fired. I said, this guy is really highly respected. And another thing that's out there, I'm sure you see it on Yankee Twitter and when they call into our show, the Buck Showalter obsession. And I just say, there's no way that Brian Cashman and what he runs would bring in Buck Showalter, because Buck Showalter would take the information. He's an information monger. He loves it. He wants every bit of information you can give him, but you're not making out his lineup. You're not telling him who to rest. There's just no way the two of them could coexist. So if you're going to bring in Showalter, then Cashman would have to leave. So that's why I don't think a move of that significance would happen. But one thing that I would watch out for, Buster, and I think it's something to watch, is that starting on Friday, the Yankees will open up their stadium to 100% capacity. Ticket sales are a big part of what the Yankees do and the money that they make and the money that they generate. If all of a sudden a team that's not exciting to watch, and if they don't win, and all of a sudden ticket sales plummet, that would be an interesting move, because other people in the organization would then have to get involved as well.
All right, something to watch. Michael, thanks for doing this. Congrats on the book.
Thank you, Buster. Thanks so much.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First up, we have Baseball Bite at Baseball Bite with a Y there. He or she writes in, "Hey, Buster, read your conversation with Sarah Langs about Vlad Jr. and how his numbers make him look the inarguable best, etc. Why is it that Astros, in spite of being the best baseball across the board in offensive numbers, are in most power rankings still not top five? Why are the Astros not a top five team?"
Probably because they haven't taken control of that division yet. But it's, look, we heard from Alex Cora, what was it last week when he said, yeah, the Astros are the best offensive team in baseball. You hope Alex Bregman, for the sake of the Astros, is not out for very long.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to TC Colorado Baseball at TCS Colorado. This person writes in, "How will National League pitchers be treated with pine tar after they bat? In theory, couldn't a pitcher bat without batting gloves and get tar on their hands and then pitch?"
I think it's a question of volume. You remember when Michael Pineda was suspended, it wasn't that, you know, unusual about that was not that he had pine tar on him, but it was in that gob. It was like a giant molehill of pine tar on his neck. And that's what baseball has been concerned about, is the volume of pine tar. So let's say a pitcher batted, he goes out to the mound and there's small remnants. I don't think the umpires would care about that. I do think they would care a lot about if they found a gob of it in his glove.
Again, something they should have a conversation about. Maybe they should try that.
Yes. Hawk, please.
For the love of God. Last one for today. Brian Tragesser at Brian Tragesser. Sorry about your name, Brian. Brian writes in, the Rockies are 5-27 away and on pace for 12.6 away wins. Has there been a worse road team in modern Major League Baseball history? I haven't found one. Well, Brian, there are two right now who are also pretty bad. The Diamondbacks, they tied the all-time consecutive road losses record last night after losing to the Giants at 22, and the Orioles are hot on their heels, having lost 18 straight on the road. So the Rockies are in good company. I can't imagine that the Rockies are kind of an outlier in all this.
Well, how about the 1899 Cleveland Spiders? And I don't have a breakdown of their home and road splits, but they finished that season 20-134. So I'm suspecting they were probably really bad on the road. That might be the standard for a completely horrible baseball, whether it was at home or on the road.
There you go, Brian. Questions answered here in Bleacher Tweets, hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
That's it for today. My thanks to Michael Kay, to Sarah Langs, to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.